Hi, I'm Eugene Laverty, BMW Motorrad Factory World Superbike Rider. Welcome to Ride and Talk, the BMW Motorrad Podcast. Here's your host, Andy Jukes.
Welcome to episode 8 of the podcast. Or should we say podcast? Because this episode was actually recorded in a car, a BMW 2 Series to be precise. I borrowed the car from my mate Carsten and sat down for a quiet chat with new BMW Motorrad Factory World Superbike Rider Eugene Laverty. It was the only quiet place we could find in Milan, but it was well worth the effort, because Eugene's an interesting guy who spoke with real depth and clarity about his career, family, fellow racers, and a love of podcasting, by the way. I hope you enjoy listening to him. I certainly did.
Brilliant. Well, welcome, Eugene. Great to have you on the podcast. You're a man of many talents and a fellow broadcaster, I hear. So what motivated you to start your own podcast series?
It was an idea I had when I was injured this year. I was sat up reading a lot of books. I read quite a bit anyway, but reading a lot of sports autobiographies at that time. And I know nowadays that people don't read just as much. So I thought, I really enjoy reading the early stages of athletes' careers, you know, that kind of first 2-3 chapters. So I thought a podcast ought to cover that. So sit down with some my fellow athletes, friends, their drivers, riders, cyclists, and just reminisce about the early days.
It's absolutely brilliant. I mean, how are you actually enjoying the experience, having done a few episodes already?
It's been good. With some of my close friends, it's been really fun. Some tales that I had no idea of, so it's been entertaining as well. And a couple of guys have even just sat down and had a beer with, so that's been even more fun. And they've just ran on. A recent one I did with my friend and rival Chaz Davies went on for like an hour and 45, so that was double what the majority of them would usually be. So one thing led to another, and before we do it, we'd almost talk for 2 hours. It's incredible once you get going and talking about those days. And we knew each other since we were kids, so it was just nice to reminisce.
Yeah, and it also makes it very hard in the edit process after, doesn't it? But it's a really nice angle you chose pre-pro. So what was the story? What motivated you to choose that subject?
Well, with athletes, we get interviewed quite a bit, and it's always about results and how things are going this year, and it's always current stuff. So I think every sports person remembers fondly how you started out. It's a little bit of the rose-tinted glasses. When you look back, you always remember the good times. So that's what the idea was, and it's surprising just how many of us started out and became professional accidentally and nobody really took it as a hobby whenever you were a teenager and thought, I can make a job out of this. It just kind of happened.
Yeah. And what about your guests like Melandri or Chaz that you just mentioned? Have they actually enjoyed the process of doing that, been able to talk freely and you know, at much more depth about the lives that they've had?
Well, the recent one I did with Marco Melandri, he didn't know what a podcast was, which was quite strange. So maybe in Italy, podcasts aren't quite as popular. So just to explain, yeah, we're going to go and talk about your early career, how you started out, which It was quite nice when you think about it. It was his last race weekend before he retired. So to go right back to the start and talk about how he began, it was something that nobody had been asking him that weekend. With Chaz Davies, it was cool doing with him because he'd listened to all the other episodes previously. He understood the dynamic of the podcast. And one of the early ones I did as well with Brendan Hartley was an F1 driver last year, and he listens to podcasts quite a bit as well, so he really just understood what people wanted to hear, and it was very intriguing.
And you've had your brothers on there too, talking about the good old days. So how important has your family been, you know, throughout your career?
Well, we all started together as kids, and we were racing for fun. Your bigger brothers are your heroes. They were riding bigger bikes than me, so I looked up to them, and it was always a case of, I'm never going to be that fast. And then within a few years, I was. So I think our sports, it always has to start from a family. When we had 6 kids in our family as well, and 3 of the boys were riding, and 2 sisters and my twin brother Eamon weren't, but they were always still at the races. So it's very much it's a family thing. But I think that's the case with all sport. You have to start out. It's a full family commitment.
Did you all fit in one van then?
There wasn't many seat belts. I think we covered that in the podcast. There was just kids bouncing around, and you maybe be sitting on a bike or do whatever, but things weren't just as strict back then. We had an old Mitsubishi van we used to bounce around, but those were good weekends. We travelled quite a bit. I can't imagine how it was from my dad running an engineering firm during the week, Monday to Friday, and then a couple of days off, and you're taking your kids to go to the motocross track for a Saturday, and then also going into County Donegal on a Sunday. There were times that we remember fondly, but I'm sure if you were to sit down with my parents, they would tell you about all the stresses and the pressures they were under.
Sure, they absolutely loved it, even in hindsight. Okay, so I was just going to ask you about Pippa. Is she your biggest rock? She's started her own podcast series as well, hasn't she?
Yeah, Pippa and I have been together right from before I was a professional, then when I was racing in British Championship. So she knows the character I was then, and yeah, people change. We've grown up together. So I would say she is my biggest rock. She knows me better than anybody, both personally and what makes me tick at the racetrack too. So that's why it's nice that we're able to travel together. And it's cool that I've been doing my podcast and now Pip has started her podcast, speaking to the support network, exactly what she is for me and the racing as well. So it's nice to hear the stories of the people that support the athletes, because those are the guys in the background, and they get to share in the glory a little bit, but probably they get more of the grief than anybody when things aren't going good.
Is there a little bit of competition between the two of you in terms of the podcast front?
No, there isn't really. I think for me, I just did it because I wanted to hear the guy's stories, so I could probably do it a lot better in terms of editing and everything else afterwards, but I've heard what I wanted to hear during the interview, so I just put it out there to allow others to share in it.
Exactly, yeah. So congrats anyway on the BMW ride for 2020. How excited are you about this?
I'm very excited, honestly. This is a bike that whenever I've watched Tom Sykes putting the bike on the podium in its first year, it's a project that I was itching to be a part of. So to get the opportunity after such a tough time with injuries, and my results haven't been anything to write home about. So just a huge thank you to BMW for giving me this opportunity to prove myself again. It's been a few years since I've won races, and I think my motivation is higher than ever, and now I've got even more experience and a wiser head on my shoulders, and I'm keen to get back to winning races.
Yeah, I mean, you've obviously seen the development of it on track and on the roads over recent years as well, you know, the new bike, especially the third generation bike. So how good do you feel it can be, you know, given a little bit more time?
Well, when I think to the first race in 2019 at Phillip Island, I was battling with Tom Sykes, and my bike was going well in a straight line, but the Ducati wasn't just quite as agile. And there was one section of the track where we went from the hay sheds to Tuluki Heights, sort of right to left, and Tom passed me in the outside. And that's when I realized, wow, this bike really turns well, because I thought I went through that section pretty good, but Tom was able to turn the bike so tight on the right that he found himself on the outside and closed the door from the outside for the next left. And from that moment, I thought, wow, they've really found something special with this bike. And other people didn't know it yet, because we were battling for, I think, ninth position or something. But from that moment, I knew that come mid-season, they were going to be fighting for the podium. And sure enough, they were. So the potential is huge. I'm sure they're working right now and finding a little bit of horsepower to help in a straight line, because that's free lap time, isn't it? So once we get that little bit sorted, I think this could be the full package.
Yeah, I mean, you've shown what you can do on the right bike, absolutely. You know, in the past, 2009, 2010 springs to mind, obviously 2013 as well. So when you have a few years where it hasn't gone so well, how do you keep the motivation as strong as it needs to be?
The motivation is as strong as ever. I think for most guys at the top of their game, it's actually the opposite problem. You have to, you know, try and care less, as strange as that sounds, because when you care too much, that's when you end up pushing too much and you make mistakes and you're too hard on yourself. Strangely enough, it's whenever you care less, or try and, you know, convince yourself that you care less, that's whenever things happen, because you just rely on your instincts then, and things happen more naturally. So I have to just make sure and keep cool and keep calm. And if you work to a routine, for me, it's all about routine. If I work to the same routine every weekend, then the results tend to come.
So it sounds like it was an easy decision to make as well, given what you just said earlier about watching Tom and what he did on the bike last year and seeing it develop throughout the year.
Yeah, it was an easy decision, and it was one that I was chasing strongly in the mid-season. I know a lot of riders were talking to different manufacturers and, you know, kind of bouncing one off the other, whereas I just was very direct and said to BMW, I want to be part of this project. How do we make it happen? I think that's why it surprised a lot of people, because I was maybe the third rider on the grid that was signed up, and the two other guys were already on previous two-year contracts. So I was the first guy to put pen to paper, and I said, I want this. And I guess they were pretty convinced as well, how direct I was, and told them I can win races again on this bike. So I think it was the right call, and we'll find out in a few weeks when I get to ride the bike for the first time.
So what about your teammate? You've known, obviously, you've grown up with all these guys. You've known Tom for years. I don't think you've ever had him as a teammate before, though.
Nope, this is the first time Tom and I will be teammates. I think the first time we actually raced together was like 2005. So that was back in British Supersport days.
Do you think together you will be able to push each other on next year?
Yeah, Tom and I as teammates is actually going to be a nice combination because we both fought for the World Superbike Championship together as rivals in 2013. And we've both matured a lot since then. And riders don't tend to get slower. We only get faster. Well, that said, as long as you've got a brain in your head, you always were working to improve. And I think Tom's a pretty smart rider as well. So I think we will push this project forward. Tom's won a lot of races and he's been a world champion before. And he's a hell of a guy for one lap in Superpole as well. So it's going to be nice working together with him and sharing a garage. I think he's always been in an inline four. I've been riding a V4 engine for the last lot of years, so it'd be interesting to compare riding styles.
Yeah, absolutely. And there's so many of these guys, especially, you know, the Brits also in World Superbike that you've grown up with, you know, for such a long time. Do you know each other inside out in terms of, you know, predicting what these guys are going to do on track in front of you, behind you? Do you know when someone's going to pull a fast move?
You do to an extent, I would say, because Tom and I first raced together in 2005 in the British Supersport Championship and battled together the following year, 2006. So, God, we're nearly a decade and a half on from there. So it is fair to say that we know each other well. And Tom's, I would say, a very safe and careful rider. So you feel pretty safe racing around him. There's a few other riders in the grid maybe aren't the same, but that tends to be the younger guys because with age and experience you get a little bit wiser and you understand the risks out there. So it is the case that in World Superbike a lot of us guys grew up racing together in British Superbike, so we know each other very well both on and off the track.
And you've raced alongside some greats, you know, in Superbike and MotoGP and 250s, and you've also had some great teammates as well. Who would you say is the most naturally gifted racer that you've ever raced with?
Oh, that's a tough question because it's a strange old thing where people talk about being naturally gifted, and I don't honestly know what that means. It's something that some people think that a guy looks natural on a bike and he's very smooth and that's naturally gifted, but it may not be the case. Maybe a rider worked on that particular riding style to smooth things out, or a guy that can maybe go out on first lap of practice be absolutely on the lap record. People think, oh, that means that he's gifted, with his other guys have to work up to it, but that's not maybe the case. It's something again that a rider may have worked on to be able to switch it on right away to be on the pace. So I don't know really how you define being naturally gifted nowadays is a tough one to call, because we have to be half rider and half engineer nowadays. Things have changed. I think you probably look at the 90s, mid-90s, when you could have looked at a guy on track and kind of assessed who was the most naturally gifted, because the guy that just went out and was able to rag a bike that he'd never ridden before probably was going to be the most naturally gifted, whereas nowadays there's so much more to it. We can gain half a second in lap time just by sitting down with an engineer on a Friday night and going through corner by corner. So it's a different ball game nowadays.
Yeah. And so would you say that, you know, that some riders work harder than others, though, you know, in terms of, you know, the work behind the scenes, the work off track, and some riders just tend to, you know, ride around problems maybe as opposed to analysing them?
Definitely, but that's not to say that a guy that, you know, that does work hard compared to a guy that doesn't work hard, that if they switch their work ethics that the results would change, because there is some guys that would say almost have an automatic brain, that things are instinctive and they don't have to sit down as much and go through every little detail, whereas there's different kinds of brains like in every walk of life, and another rider may need to be very analytical and sit down and really delve through the information to produce the lap time. So every person is different, and in turn that means then every rider is different in how they work. And I think team managers, they have to understand that. They have to look at two different riders and not think one's being lazy and one's a hard worker. It may just be the case that that's what works for that rider.
And that's, I guess, what makes a successful team manager, being able to understand the rider well enough to effectively build the team around the rider.
Yeah, and it is critical. I'd say one of the best guys I worked with was Gigi Deligna, who's now the leader of the Ducati project in MotoGP, and I worked with him at Aprilia, and I guess I was intimidated before I went there, and I was so used to team managers and people always second guessing me and questioning me, and if I was dropping back at the end of a race or something, they would look and go, yeah, are you not training enough, or, you know, always looking at what you're eating and all the rest. Whereas Gigi Deligne trusted the rider to do his job and didn't second guess them, and I think that's why he's such a great leader.
Oh, that's really interesting information. So a much easier question, I think, would be, you know, who's the most frustrating guy you've ever raced again? So somebody who's like really, really difficult to pass and unpredictable, but obviously still safe.
There is some riders that I think they forget that we're in a sort of 35-minute time trial. It's the fastest guy from when the lights go out to the checkered flag. So some guys on lap 6 or 7 will start lunging and running you wide and all the rest and allow somebody to get away. So it can be frustrating whenever you're racing against somebody like that. Guy nowadays like Michael Vandermark we race against, he's really aggressive and he can be frustrating at times, but on his day he's super fast. He's a very late breaker, so hard to race against, but yeah, he's not shy on moving around on the track and touching riders, so he's a tough one. You've always got to keep an eye on him.
Now, you spoke about injuries a little bit earlier on. How's your fitness now after the injuries this year?
The last couple of rounds in Argentina and Qatar were the first where I wasn't really having any issues with my right wrist at the end of a race. So I really was able to enjoy those races. Not 100% still, but just I'll be able to get that up to par over the winter. But when I say I'm not 100%, it means that I don't have 100% range of my wrist, what I did have before the accident. But in terms of riding a motorbike, it's more than enough. It's what I need.
Yeah, so it hasn't stopped you doing all your other training that you love to do, such as your cycling. Why such a love of this sport? I think you're absolutely cycling mad, aren't you?
I do enjoy cycling, but I'm always very wary to remind myself that I'm a motorbike racer. There's a lot of guys, particularly in MotoGP, that train like cyclists. And when they crash, they tend to break bones, which ain't good, because if you cycle every day, your bone density gets pretty brittle and you can break easily. So I always make sure and switch it up. I do love riding the bike, but as soon as I get strong riding the bike, I park it for a while and go running or go to the gym and change it up, because you got to remember, your job is to be a motorbike racer, so there's no point in trying to chase the pros.
Sounds like you do a lot of thinking sort of scientifically about, you know, being the best you can be in all the different areas. Have you researched a lot, or have you had some really good advice or a combination of both of that over the years?
I was fortunate early in my career to work with some good people. Even when I was with Red Bull 10 years ago, I spent a lot of time at their diagnostics and training centre in Austria and learned a lot there from the doctors. And I'd say that was where I made the biggest step, and from that I was able to control my own training. I haven't had a coach since then. So once you know what works for you, it's just a matter of building on that. I think there's some guys that get bored and every couple of years they want to really change things, but for me, I think I've known for the past decade what works for me as a motorbike racer, and you got to continue on with that, because these people like new fads, and fads come and go. I'm not really one for fads. If it worked for me 10 years ago, it's still going to work for me now.
And do you train alone, or do you tend to mix it up a little bit?
I train more now with other people than I used to. I used to always train solo years ago, because that's the most efficient work. Then if you're going out for 2 hours, you're probably training for 2 hours. So sometimes when you're with a group, then you may not get just as good quality training. But I realise now, for your mind during the season, sometimes it's good to just go out and chew the fat with some of your friends and be active. That's the most important thing. Most of my training is done in the winter, I would say, these next couple of months. In December and January, I'll do all my training alone. That's when the key work's done, and by the time the end of January comes, if you haven't trained by then, in my opinion, it's too late. Season starts, and it's just a matter of maintaining your level from then.
Do you stay around your base in Monaco during the winter? Have you got, you know, a lot of stuff around you there that you can do? Or
yeah, the weather's always been good there, and that's where I'm very fortunate. It means that I can still go out in December and January. If I want to ride at 9 a.m, I can, because the sun's already up. So that's something that I enjoy a lot about living in the continent, having that weather to make things easier. It's probably made me a lot softer than what I was when I lived in Ireland.
You're not missing those grey skies.
Yeah, but my problem is now if I go back home, I'm so soft. And I can't think back to the times whenever I used to go it was a little bit stupid, but I remember even riding in the snow back then and just saying, ah, oh, there's no such thing as bad weather, only bad clothing.
Yeah, and the brothers would have egged each other on, wouldn't they?
Exactly that. I bet that was a bit tougher then, so now I'm just soft to it. I'm just a fair weather rider and cyclist nowadays.
And what about the trails riding? Do you still enjoy doing that?
Yeah, I haven't done as much recently, but I really do enjoy that. There's something about the technical aspect that I really appreciate. You wouldn't believe how many like top super bike riders and MotoGP riders that are used to riding it 200, 250 kilometers an hour, and you put them on a trials bike where they have to go 15, 20, and they're terrible. Because strange as it sounds, whenever you're riding fast, things kind of happen slower because we're in a big wide open track. And you're set flat out in a straight line, you move your body across to the side, close the gas, brake, it's all in slow motion. You go on a trials bike at 15 kilometers an hour and you're going from one rock to another and you have to shut the gas, grab the brakes immediately, grab the clutch. You put a super bike rider on a trials bike and they try and do that. They do everything together and they end up going over the handlebars. So I think that's why it's intrigued me, because I realised, oh, there's something about this sport that teaches you the basics, and then surely that can transfer across to our sport as well.
Do you enjoy the other kinds of off-road riding as well?
I grew up riding motocross, so I think that's something that I love, that's always got to remain with me. I enjoy riding supermoto as well. In recent years, I've tried a little bit of flat track, like at Valentino Rossi's ranch. That place is paradise. What he has set up there is something else. The academy riders that he has, the VR46 academy guys that get the train there every week, I don't think they realise just truly how lucky they are, because that's probably the most fun form of motorsport that I've ever come across, riding flat track.
And just going back to our naturally gifted question earlier, would he not fall into that category, or are you going to tell me that he's an incredibly hard worker and has been ever since he was 8 years old?
I've heard from some of his teammates that he is a hard worker on the race weekend, you know, and he does that a lot with the engineer, going through all this sort of data and the evidence to try and squeeze out every little percent. If I think about MotoGP riders now on the grid, and you really have to look at what you can truly say is naturally talented, maybe it's a guy like Jorge Lorenzo, because he just you know, whenever he's on song, he's absolutely on song, but whenever he's off the ball, then he's terrible. And to me, that's what a natural rider is, because if you have a rider that's really worked on honing your craft, you don't have off days, because you understand 100% what you're doing on that bike. So you should never have a day where you're finishing the podium, winning races, and then the next day 18th place. And when you look at a guy like Marc Marquez, he's a guy that's, I don't think we've ever seen his like before, because he is somebody you could say has a natural talent. He's also a smart guy. He's got balls of steel. He's just the most complete package.
So just going back to the roads, and bearing in mind where you come from, were you never tempted to go down that road?
No, road racing wasn't something that interested me, honestly. I grew up watching it, and I still do enjoy watching it, but it's a different mindset. The guys that do road racing, they have no fear, and even some of the guys that I would have raced in British Championship with that went on to do road racing, I can kind of look back and think, oh yeah, them guys had a different kind of outlook in life to me. So it's not something that I would ever do. It's a different way of riding as well. I think what gives me a buzz is being able to push at 100% and push the limits and not be scared of crashing. Whereas if I think about going on the roads, I would never be able to push to that level. I would have to rein it back, and to me that would mean riding at 80 to 90%, and that wouldn't really give me a buzz.
No, but I found it really interesting talking to Peter Hickman for the podcast earlier this year, and he's had a cracking year, hasn't he? I mean, it's been interesting to see what he's done this year on the road. So would you say that the stock bike is pretty impressive compared to most stock bikes?
Well, Peter Hickman this year has been incredible, even at the Isle of Man TT on the stock bike. The sort of lap time he was doing there shows that the BMW as a standard bike, it's a super bike that you can buy and go racing with. So Peter, watching him now, he's so smooth, and he's a rarity, and a guy that was on a good level on circuit racing, and then he went road racing, and it almost appears that his road racing helped how he rides in the circuits, because he goes to a track like Thruxton in the UK and he always wins there, or at least on the podium, because he's so silky smooth. And carries a lot of speed through the fast flow and quarters, so he's probably the best all-round rider nowadays. There's not many guys that can be at the front on the circus and on the road, so I think he's something else right now.
You hit the nail on the head there, and that's exactly what he said. He'd said that his road racing had helped him on the circus. Probably for that, but for a lot of other people, it actually holds them back, doesn't it? They find it hard to make that transition. But for a customer buying a Double R, like you say, you know, it is a super bike. What advice would you give to them if they're buying these bikes? Because predominantly you're going to be riding them on the roads. Get some training, I guess.
Yeah, get some training. Get on a track, because that's where you're going to learn it. Because people, I think, naturally want to improve. And the smartest thing is to go on to a track, because you don't understand where the limit is until you try and push them. So first get on a track, get schooled, and yeah, you're going to improve that way. So the guys are always obsessed with horsepower, with speed, and often neglect suspension. And if you're on the open road, suspension could make your ride a lot easier and safer.
Oh, that's brilliant. It's been really interesting talking to you, Eugene. Thanks ever so much for coming on the podcast. Good luck with your podcast. What's it called again, and where can people find it?
So my podcast is called Pre-Pro. I've done more than a dozen episodes now, and start out on SoundCloud, but you can get it on Apple Podcasts as well. So yeah, have a listen and let me know what you think.
Yeah, well, I've certainly listened to the opening four or five episodes. It's very entertaining, and I can learn a lot from it as well. So good luck with continuing with that, and good luck with the season that's lying ahead.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Cheers. Thanks, Eugene. Some great insights there into top-level bike racing and the mindsets of the talented guys who make their living entertaining all of us superbike fans. I'm now interested to get Tom Sykes on the podcast, so let's see what we can do there. By the way, who else do you want to hear on Ride and Talk? Why not get in touch and tell us who or what you'd like to listen to on a future show? It could even be you if you've got an interesting story to tell. Until next time, bye for now.